Commander Rappard, Rail 34. Now, just before we finish with this, there is a point about the change of designation of the whole Admiralty.
Yes, the board of the Admiralty had been an institution in British history for centuries. And it had been in the same building in Whitehall for centuries as well. And indeed, the wind vane on the roof of the Admiralty building was actually repeated within the Board of Admiralty room, the Admiralty boardroom, to show which way the wind was blowing in case the French were going to come out and sail against us in the Napoleonic times. So when the Admiralty ceased to be the name of the prime office of the naval staff and was changed to the Ministry of Defence brackets Navy, there were those who felt we were all going downhill and it didn't blow like it used to and all those sort of noises. And I recorded my opinion at the time that the dishonest socialist defence review set the services at each other's throats. I wasn't allowed out earlier, and the 1/7 of my pension was docked because I had resigned between two golden bellers. In order to move our office from the old Admiralty building across the road to the Ministry of Defence building, we were told we had to come in on Saturday night and Sunday and clear our desks and carry the stuff across the road to the new building. And so there was a most undignified and really quite comical affair of secret papers blowing out of in-baskets around Whitehall as we walked across there. And a lot of the naval staff being somewhat critical of the political decisions which led to this sort of stupidity. It didn't help one's morale one little bit. But I was intrigued to find that Henry VIII's wine cellar was built into the foundations of the new Ministry of Defence building.
Did it have a name?
It's the Ministry of Defence building. It's the one overlooking the Thames, in fact. However, I set to right away with my main task, which was job hunting. And in my photograph album, opposite my picture at that stage, I've written in The Pensioner and job hunting with the help of the CV, which I had recorded. Now, whether you're interested in the CV as I've written it, I've no idea. But
probably not. I think if you just sort of show us how you got the job, because you went to Kodak, didn't you?
Well, not right away. No, it was more difficult than that. Once out of the Navy and having a date and knowing that it was up to me what I was going to do and knowing what size my pension was going to be and therefore how much money I had to earn to keep the show on the road because I had three children, I set about talking to all the friends I had working in industry or whatever and asked for their help. And I found that, first of all, I had to write a CV. Well, that was something I'd never had to do before, and the industry which helps one to write a CV nowadays didn't exist. So rather naively, I went along to places to be interviewed. My friends had got me interviews, and they said, "What can you do?" And I said, "I can drive a ship." And they said, "I don't have any ships. What else can you do?" And I said, "Well, I've led a lot of people." And they said, "But that was in a disciplined service. How does that apply to civil life?" And I then found somebody who told me how to write a CV. And I found that I could write up my expertise in a way which I didn't recognize, but which the civilians did. I said that I was a magistrate. I had experience of a magistrate, because in the Navy I was allowed to put people into cells. I found that I had accounting skills because I had to look after the books in various occasions. I found that I'd been involved in strategic planning in the Admiralty, that I was highly regarded as a man with skills of keeping secrets because I'd been in the Directorate of Naval Intelligence. In fact, one way and another, what I was learning was something the Navy had told me years ago, that bullshit baffles brains. In those circumstances, I began to make a bit of progress. I decided that I could not accept less than £2,000 a year to keep the family show on the road, and that was even with the help of my mother and brother paying school fees and things like that, because sadly the Navy had been very slow in realizing, and the Army and the Air Force, that the Foreign Office allowed their people to receive the half the fees if they sent their children to boarding school because they had overseas postings, but the services did not. It was one of those events where the civil servants in Whitehall were looking after their own, and to hell with the armed services. But I began to get the idea, and eventually finished up being interviewed in Kodak by a charming gentleman who'd taken photographs for the Navy as a civilian during the war, because his eyesight was so bad he couldn't be in any of the armed services, and he had a soft spot for the Navy. But, there was a possibility that there might be a job for me. They were starting something new, and if I came and had lunch with them, we could talk about it with some of his friends. So I was taken over to Harrow, the film factory at Harrow, and taken into what I subsequently found was the Holy of Holies for the most important people in the company, who had been there a long time and had all the privileges and so on. Most of them are PhD chemists anyway. And they decided to employ me at £2,500 a year, which was tremendous.
What else?
Well, that was a bit woolly. But would I come to Ruislip, and then I would help find out what it was, because I was going to be something to do with training, which I'd done before, of course, in the services, and something to do with a new thing called computing. And nobody was quite sure what it involved. Well, clearly Kodak had a room about the size of half a tennis court, absolutely full of tapes and paper and all the rest of it. But a few obscure people worked in that, and they couldn't explain in English what they did anyway. But increasingly they were important to the company because money was involved, of course, and payment and so on. And since Kodak's payments involved something like £1 million a day, it was important they got it right. Then I found that they had a training system, because I wasn't given an office or anything like that. I sat in a sort of room by myself. No secretary, nothing. I had to go around and talk to people. And I found to my amazement that nobody had a clear idea about how to train computer programmers, for example. They sat by Nelly and watched people do this clever thing and eventually learned a bit about it. And then I found it wasn't just the computer programmers, it was the industrial engineers, the organization and methods people, the operations research people. All of them were terribly secretive about what they did or how they'd learned how to do what they did. And they were not prepared to tell a newcomer who clearly hadn't been in the company more than 2 minutes, because it was a cradle-to-grave employer, how they were doing it. So I was left to invent a new way of doing this from scratch. There was a political decision had been taken by the government to encourage training, so that they would charge a tax, which in effect took money away for training, and you could earn it back if you could deliver training to the right level. And it took me about a year and a half to do this, but I got to the point where I wrote a policy paper. I was invited to sell it to the 300 people in the Administrative Services Division. And it was so successful that we were getting back 300% of what we were paying out as tax for training. And that caught the eye of the accountant somewhere up in the top world of Kodak. So to my intense surprise, about 2.5 years after going there, I found myself on the umpteenth floor of the head office of Kodak in America, telling an international Kodak audience how to deal with training for computer staff, which, as I was very bad at the idea of programming anything myself, was another example of bullshit baffling brains, except that it worked and it brought in money. So I was given carte blanche to get on with it. So I recruited staff in the sense of trainers, and I had people who'd worked for IBM and so on and knew about these things. And just as I was getting underway, the man who ran the computer department within this Administrative Services Division was sent for to go to America. And our joint boss said, who would he put in charge? And he said, oh, well, I'll put old so-and-so in. He knows what the form is about programming. And my boss said, no, I'm not going to have that. I'm going to put David Rappard in charge of the computer department. So I found that they never talked to each other. They were all so damn clever with computers and things that they never actually spoke. And in those circumstances, I said I was going to have a staff meeting every morning at 8:45, and it was not going to last more than a quarter of an hour, and I wanted to know what had happened overnight, because it was a crisis sort of period in the night when things went wrong, and everybody ran around like blue-eyed flies trying to put it right so we could get the accounts out. And they said, well, we'll never be able to do that. And I was advised not to do it, and I ignored the advice. And I had one chair in the room only, and everybody else stood. And I said, I want reports on anything which did not go according to plan last night, and I want it in 1 minute each, please. And so we got the things done that way, and then I had a sort of task force to do it. Then I found that some of the people talking to me in the morning hadn't been to bed all night. And nobody took the slightest notice of that. The fact they were cross-eyed with lack of sleep and they were trying to think straight wasn't seen as a major problem. I thought it was. So I got the catering people in the company from Harrow to come over, and I said, I want hot food available for these people in the middle of the night when they're 3 o'clock in the morning, they're called in from their homes to mend something. And in fact, I was doing what the Navy had taught me of bringing together the resources of people and the backup they required to deliver the goods which Kodak required from them. And it caused a bit of a stir, as you would imagine. I was very lucky in the sense that my old tennis partner from the Navy, and he and I had played against the Royal Air Force and so on, a chap called Von Turner, who was a commander, retired also from the gunnery division, as it happened, and he and I had run specialist courses in gunnery and undersea warfare, which I had described earlier, was also employed in Kodak in the personnel division. And when I really got my knickers in a twist by upsetting everybody locally at Ryslip, I'd ring up Paul Turner and say, help, how on earth do I deal with this? And he would arrange lunch with the head of catering or the chief personnel director or something like that, in order to help me unscramble the awful rows I was creating by cutting through Kodak red tape and traditional ways of doing things. Fortunately, my boss, the partially blind man, backed me up to the hilt. So I really was truly amazed to be in America very quickly talking to people. But two things amazed me about it. One was the actual job. The other was the social background to it. I was invited out to dinner every night by a different family in Rochester, and my hostesses always asked me the same question. Who did you go to dinner with last night? Was the food any good? And who did you like there? Well, any one of those questions, a straight answer could have dropped me in it in a very big way indeed, so I had to be immensely tactful. So eventually they created a huge office party of the whole thing that I was involved in a park where we took one of the wooden huts for the party, and everybody in the there were about 100-150 people there, plus children. They all competed to demonstrate that they could bring a better lunch than anybody else. And my particular hostess was producing souffles for the picnic lunch, and she had the cooker built into the car so she could do it. Understandably, I opted out of that argument and went and joined the children playing softball. And because I'd been a cricketer as a young man, I didn't want to catch the softball wearing a glove. I found it much easier to catch without gloves. And the children unanimously said, get that! He doesn't need a glove. He's English. So on the way back, I decided to walk back when I got within striking distance my hotel, and I found there was a huge parade going on in Rochester with marching bands and all the rest of it, and the fire brigade was going by, and I found the fire brigade lorries were stacked high with beer, and the police vans were stacked high with beer, and quite obviously there was going to be a monumental party. There was a broadcaster, a loudspeaker from a van on the side of the road, and I stuck my nose in there to say, what is all this? And one of them turned over his shoulder and said, hi, there's a limey here, wants to know what's going, what's cooking. So I was invited in, and I found myself on local radio in Rochester broadcasting about an Englishman's view of their parade, which I didn't even know what it was all about. So it was deeply interesting, and the crucial meeting was on my last day there, when I'd had to go to two dinners the night before because my social program had got tangled somewhere. And at this meeting, I was asked to advise on which of three or four proposals for doing all the training in Eastman Kodak should be followed. And to my horror, they accepted my advice on the spot. So I found that the Americans were remarkable, as they always have been in my experience, quite different to anything we do, no matter whether it's naval or anything else. And whatever I did there didn't harm what happened to me when I got back to Ruislip, and I was eventually promoted and given a bigger office and all that sort of thing. It was a very interesting experience because I was talking one language and the people I was with were talking a completely different language because we came to it from a totally different background.
Did you eventually found your sort of, you joined them, you know, in the sense that
I don't think
you
it ever became quite as perfect as that. I certainly, treated me with considerable respect just in case I'd do something wild and free, I think. But the man who ran the outfit was charming and eventually retired. And the man who took over from him was a mathematician, in fact. And he and I got on pretty well together. And my 20 years in Kodak delivered another pension, which was, after all, part of the drill.
So you were with Kodak from 1964 to 80?
66 to 86.
And what did you do? You had yet another career after that.
Well, I did. I had become interested from about 1980, the early 1980s anyway, in healing, holding a hand over somebody, and some benefit to some people sometimes resulting. I'd found to my considerable alarm that I had a bit of a gift of healing because one of my children, a 15-year-old who was at boarding school, came home at the beginning of the summer holidays having hurt her back moving furniture in the school play, which is the sort of thing that happens. And by 11 o'clock at night, it was quite clear that she wasn't going to sleep easily, and nor were we, therefore. And as I'd read in the newspaper something about healing that day, I suggested she came and laid herself out on our bunk in a pair of knickers, and I would go through what the Daily Mail said, or whatever the newspaper was. And paragraph one of this was, wave a pendulum over it. Well, I hadn't got a pendulum, so I got my dog whistle out. One of the joys of being retired was I could now have a dog, which I'd always longed to do. And I waved this dog whistle over her back, and to my surprise, it didn't do what I expected it to do. It went round the wrong way in one particular place. So I said, oh, it's funny, a couple of places, and two places it went wrong in. I put my finger on her back and said, here and here, to keep her amused, because she was face diamonds. She said, how did you know about the other one, Daddy? I've only told you about one. So I said, well, I don't know. Come on, let's try paragraph two. So I ditched the dog whistle and held a hand over it, which is what paragraph two said, about 6 inches clear. And to my intense surprise, over one of the places where the dog whistle had done something odd, I felt pins and needles in the palm of my hand. Something I'd never felt before in those circumstances. I'm not in the habit of holding my hand over people anyway. And almost at once, she said, what are you doing, Daddy? It feels weird. I said, I'm not doing anything, darling. I'm not even touching you. I'm about 6 inches clear. I never had anything like this before, she said. It feels hot. So she let it run for about 15 minutes. And then she said, oh, I'm going to bed. So I smacked her on the bottom and off she went to bed, because that, after all, was the object of the drill. We all wanted to go to sleep. Next morning, she had no trace of any discomfort at all, which I found very alarming indeed, because I was really following a newspaper article. I wasn't deeply convinced or anything like that. So I set out to find out a bit more about it, what on earth I'd got involved in this time, in effect. And I found that my old brother, who was suffering considerably from arthritis and who had had to retire from his job as chairman of Stavely Industries, chairman and chief executive of Stavely Industries, was badly in need of help. I also found out that the governor of the Tower of London's wife was running a healing clinic in the Queen's House of the Tower of London, and that the governor, Major General Sir Digby Raeburn, was extremely anxious that the pictorial and the sun should not actually realize that this was happening. Well, as I knew this lady, I introduced Dennis to her and persuaded him. He was very reluctant to get mixed up with any nonsense like that, of course. I persuaded him to go down there on the grounds that he'd never seen the inside of the Queen's House, the Tower of London, anyway, where they lived. So he went down there, and she led him out and held a hand over him, and he had the most astonishing relief of some of the pain that he had. And she was a very interesting person anyway, so he decided to go down there frequently. His doctor, who had been instrumental in making him retire from Stavely Industries because he was in such a mess, happened to be a very senior doctor in the Bupa. I think he was the chief doctor of Bupa or something like that, who had been down to examine all the directors of Stavely. And Dennis became convinced that this was something interesting, and the doctor became so convinced it was something interesting that when Dennis, with my support, started the Confederation of Healing Organizations, this doctor became the president of it, and Dennis became the chairman. And when I retired 4 years later from Kodak, I became the administrator, because by then the paperwork was overwhelming my brother in his house in North London. And quite clearly there was something useful I could do. And when Dennis himself became 80, he decided to retire because he was getting very bad-tempered indeed. And he left and I became the chairman. They elected me chairman. And I ran it for another 9 years after that. In that role, I found myself on my hind legs in Norway and Oslo, talking to all the Norwegian and Northern European healers, leaders of their outfits anyway, and in Spain, talking to them there. And I became, I'm now a member of the Royal Society of Medicine, rather to my surprise. I didn't push my own ability as a healer to anybody because I didn't think I've got much of a gift of healing. But in the course of this, my brother and I set out to create something which was reputable, which would bring doctors into it, say, not at any stage saying we knew better than doctors, and which involved government to the extent that I had access to the Minister of Health, and indeed I addressed the Parliamentary Group for Complementary and Alternative Medicine at their request at some stage on how we were doing this thing in a respectable way. So for some 10, 14 years after leaving the Navy, I had another job. And after leaving Kodak, yes, I had another job. And rather surprisingly, as I left the job and said, look, 9 years is long enough to be chairman of this, and it's time for somebody else to do it, they were so pleased with what I'd done that they gave me £300 for to buy a set of books about the sea, the O'Brien books. So the whole thing came back full circle. Since then, they've been biting each other's backsides and falling apart, but that's another story. The story which is close to my heart at the moment, because my old brother Dennis was unfortunately diagnosed as being demented about 2 years before he died, changed his will, and went against everything he'd agreed in the past, and I'm now up the neck in legal troubles trying to upset that will.
And what about overall? Do you still, well, I mean, we met you through the Captain Class Association, which is from your time at HMS Barrow. Do you still keep your close links with the Navy through any other association?
No, I don't. Well, I did at one time. The Arctic Convoy Club caught my eye about 3 years ago. And so I wrote to the chairman of it because I'd been up to Murmansk a couple of times during the war and found that they were going to have a meeting in St. Petersburg about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. And I joined it, and they invited me to come up there. And I found myself addressing a whole lot of Russians in a meeting there under the governor of St. Petersburg's chairmanship about our role in the Russian convoys during the war. And we were given a most generous time by the Russians, who bent over backwards to take us to the superb ballet up in St. Petersburg and to see the beauties of the place and the Tsar's palace and all the other things.
So that's one. What about the captain's class thing?
Captain class frigates I joined later, but I'll just finish the other one. Since then, since the time I went to St. Petersburg, the Arctic Convoy Club chairman died, and a new man has taken over who has set as his main objective is to get a special medal for the Arctic convoys. And I see in the newspapers again last week it's going on. I resigned from this outfit over that issue because all of them who had served in the North Atlantic had received the North Atlantic Medal. And I felt very strongly that there was nothing sufficiently special about the Arctic convoys compared to service and getting convoys across the Atlantic, where people were killed in heaps as well, and that they were pushing a political point and giving entirely the wrong atmosphere to it, which I was not prepared to be associated with in any way. So I wrote to the new man in charge and said so. And that the captain class frigates had an association which had extended my knowledge that HMS Byron had an association as well. I attended their get-together last year for the first time, and the thing which attracted me most was that this was entirely run by sailors, not by officers at all, and that they were doing it so well that there was nothing really for me to do unless they asked me to do it. And when I found that I'd been invited to make a speech at their dinner, I was really honored by it. And I felt that the right approach was to emphasize how important the sailors had been to the whole of my naval career, the ratings, compared to what the officers had been doing.
On that note, we'll finish. Thank you very much.